here and welcome to the Pack Heavy podcast. Now, this podcast is for anyone who works in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries who use flexible packaging to get their products to market. Featuring interviews with guests who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. I call this mindset the Pack Heavy mentality, and it's primarily driven by deliberate action and extreme organization. You gather market intelligence, put a strong plan in place, organize the appropriate resources, and then confidently test your hypothesis against reality. So if you're ready to pack heavy on your vision, you're in the right place, and I'm excited to have you here. Good morning, and welcome to episode 25 of the Pack Heavy podcast. Today, I'm excited to have a good chat with Ben Didier of Pretty Ugly Design. Ben is an independent graphic designer and illustrator based in Vancouver, BC, who established his business Pretty Ugly Design in 2006. Ben specializes in branding, packaging, and print projects with a focus on illustration, lettering, and custom typography. If you haven't checked out Ben's Instagram feed or website, I highly recommend it, as I'm sure that you'll recognize some of his work like Jordan Hocking, Sriracha Revolver Hot Sauce, who I actually had on the show on episode 22. I've been following Ben on Instagram for quite a while, and coming from the coffee industry, there are some brands that I know that I didn't even realize that Ben had created, like 49th Parallel Coffee Roasters, East Van Coffee Roasters, and Coffee Supreme, which is local to back in Melbourne and Auckland. But there is so much more to the portfolio that Ben has done that's really unique, and I recommend that you hit pause right now before we kick off and check it out. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. How's the week wrapped up for you?
Yeah, it's funny, just days blur together. So the fact that it's Friday is kind of lost on me most times.
But yeah, I bet. What does your week usually comprise of? Are you a solo, like you work by yourself?
Yeah. Just one man show.
Yeah. So how does the week sort of like pan out for you? How many projects do you generally have on the go at one time?
I mean, it's impossible. There's no like set flow. So it's kind of feast or famine sometimes.
Yeah.
Luckily, I've maintained a good level of business over the years. So, it's never too dry. But I'm a creature of habit. So I like routine. So just, waking up in the morning, that's usually when I get all the emails and communication done. And then I can kind of turn everything off and get creative for the rest of the day after that. So,
do you find that your most creative hours are in the AM more so than the PM, or are you sort of a bit of a night owl as well?
It really depends. Not a night owl anymore. That was definitely in my 20s, but now I like good square meals and 9 to 5 hours.
Yeah, I hear you.
Burning the midnight oil is for the young.
Yeah, you got to have that balance in life, don't you?
Yeah.
So where did you grow up? Are you a Vancouver native?
Victoria. So,
right.
And then I went to high school in Comox Valley on Vancouver Island.
Okay.
So I moved to Vancouver 2003.
Yeah. What brought you across?
Just the draw of the city, I guess, is kind of the main thing. There's just so much happening, especially for somebody who's younger. You know, there's the island is a great place to grow up, and I really love it. But I think as far as opportunities and stuff, the city has quite a bit more to offer. So
yeah, especially early on in your career as well. There's the population, and what I've found, back when I was working in the coffee industry, my patch was Vancouver Island as well. So I was getting across every 5 to 6 weeks, and even here at Food Pack, a vast majority of my clients are on the island as well, but I haven't been able to travel because of COVID. But yeah, I love getting across, but I definitely noticed the slower pace of everybody.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a draw for me now. Like it's kind of one of those things where that's the thing you're running away from fastest when you're young.
Yeah.
And then now it's a draw. Like you just get over to the island and that first step off the boat is just slower pace, and it's a very welcome thing. So there's definitely a draw to the place, and I take all my holidays there and stuff. So
it's
a beautiful spot.
Your family's back there still as well?
Yeah. Cowichan and Valley now, they kind of moved south. So
Very good. So at what point in your life did you realize that you wanted to be a designer? Was it something that was always in your DNA and you were drawing as a little kid?
Yeah, definitely. From as long as I can remember, just always, a good supportive house, I guess, grew up in as far as art goes, always stuff on the fridge. And I guess high school is obviously where you kind of realize that there could be a career in something creative. So that's kind of where the shift happened. And then started, I guess, just doing covers for zines in like music, like a lot of CD covers and self-produced stuff, small record labels, and then just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, yeah. I just looking through your portfolio of artwork, like your artwork is so recognizable out there. Once you see it, I can recognize it. And I notice that you do a lot by hand, but if you're taking on other sort of medias into your repertoire as well?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to limit myself. So I love texture and doing things the old fashioned way, and then combining that with obviously newer technologies. So everything ends up on the computer eventually.
Yeah.
When it comes to actual rendering skills as an artist, like I'd say I would be lost without the computer, because I'm just so used to that as the editing medium where you can, you know, the undo feature is just, once you've grown up with that, it's impossible to go back. So I have tons of respect for people that stay physical, you know, without the digital aspects from start to finish, but I definitely lean heavily on the digital.
Yeah. I mean, the photography industry has completely changed. My sister-in-law is a wedding photographer and her father was a wedding photographer, but he used to obviously do everything in film. And so, you know, Mel will be scrolling through and she can look at her shots and retake shots and all of that kind of stuff. But when you were doing it all with film, you were so limited. And then it was a guessing game as to what you were going to end up with. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But I, you know, this is impossible to hear, because like when you go to art school, they always tell you like, learn how to do it the hard way so that you can appreciate the ease of the digital. And then you just have that wealth of knowledge to bring to it. And that's the last thing you want to hear when you're 20. You want to just get straight into Photoshop.
Yeah.
But there's so much truth to it. Like when you know, the entire process from start to finish, starting with a pencil, I think it's just there's better bones to the project.
Yeah, it's a solid foundation to sort of build upon. Yeah, cool. Sure. So where did you actually study design?
Yeah, it's kind of a weird story, but I applied for Cap College because it had a good balance of illustration with design. And I kind of liked that marriage of the two, because a lot of programs, it's kind of one or the other.
Yeah.
And then literally like a month before I was set to come to the city to go to school, they canceled the program. So it was kind of unheard of, like to already have admissions and accept, and like you're pretty much ready to pay your tuition, and then they canceled it to retool the curriculum. So it's kind of a last minute thing. So I was kind of left scrambling, but luckily there was a really good alternative in the Comox Valley where I was living, where you could do your first couple of years of an Emily Carr degree locally at North Island College. So I ended up going that route. Fell in love with screen printing too, which was amazing. There was actually a lot of benefits to being in a smaller town for that, because there was so much less demand on the facilities. So like I kind of had the run of the screen printing studio for most of my classes, which was amazing. So I ended up, you know, pivoting well, but yeah, just did 2 years. I didn't finish my diploma, my degree or anything.
Yeah. And from there, did you go straight into working for yourself, or did you go and work for an agency or a small little studio to get your feet wet?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't exclusively in design. I, you know, did other jobs, carpentry, cabinetry.
Yeah.
Always design on the side. And then, eventually started freelancing full time. And then got an opportunity to work at CBC in-house. Yeah, so I worked on the radio side, and that was amazing. That was just like the perfect opportunity for me at that time. And so I was there for 4 years and I loved it. It was just an amazing group of people to work with. I grew up on CBC, so it was kind of like working for your dream client in a lot of respects.
Yeah.
So that was great. And then I was freelancing at the same time, and it was just becoming untenable to do both because I was working evenings and weekends, and it was just kind of crazy. So eventually it was enough freelance work that I could just jump into that full time. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess you would have noticed the shift in the pace, and I guess the extra responsibilities of running your own operation as well. How did that all go for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, if a lot of that, you know, especially if you've been doing it hard time before you jump in full time, you know the ins and outs of it. And so it's good to have that balance. Like, you know, it's nice to be creative 100% of the time, but there's a draw to that too. Like it takes a lot out of you. So it's nice to have that balance of like, okay, now it's paperwork time and now we're doing communication, and to have it all in one person is challenging, obviously, but I think over the years you just, you know, you play to your strengths and you figured out
Yeah, 100%. Mate, I was really excited to have you on the podcast today and have the ability to talk to you. Because as I mentioned in the intro, like, I have been following you for years, and I don't know how you came onto my radar, but I followed you straight away. And yeah, like I said, your work's definitely recognizable. You're actually the third designer to come onto the podcast. I think it was episode 3 or 4. I had Clay Yandel from Eggbeater Creative, who does some outstanding work out there. Then I had Emma Fanning and Saston Phillips of Little Fox Design, and they're based over in Victoria. And their focus really is on sustainable design and incorporating when they're, you know, working with organizations and trying to develop their packaging, trying to figure out what the most sustainable solutions are. I really wanted to talk to you today because I know that you've done Jordan Hocking's work at Sriracha Revolver, and I thought that was an outstanding piece and it was really unique. And the thing that I loved about the Sriracha Revolver story is that, you know, Jordan told us on the podcast that, you know, when she sat down with you, you instantly knew what her vision was. Like, you just had this really good grasp of what it is that she was looking for. And she said that there weren't any real iterations on the artwork. You like sort of nailed it the first time. And I thought that was really awesome. So I really wanted to talk to you about the mechanics of the design process that you undertake with a client, and what it actually looks like and what questions you ask. And was that a typical experience for you, or was that kind of unique?
Yeah, that's definitely like an outlier to have no revisions. Like, you mm-hmm. build in a lot of back and forth, and that's just part of the typical design process. So yeah, getting it on a first try is pretty rare. I mean, in terms of the average, like, the more information you have up front from a client, the better off you stand to, you know, get it right the first time. And Jordan was a great example. She had a great vision for the project. She wasn't micromanaging. She wasn't like telling you exactly what you go where, but she had a very clear understanding of what you wanted, and she was able to communicate that. And so that is really easy to work with when you have somebody who has a good idea what they want and they're able to communicate it. I mean, there's very little room for failure because it's just, everything's on the table. You know, and that's not always the case, and that's fine too. Sometimes there's a lot more mystery involved, but early on, especially, it's just about narrowing it down, trying to avoid any big surprises. I often like to tell people too, like, when you're putting together references, things that have caught your eye, show me things you don't like too, because that's often even more valuable. And a lot of people don't think of that, but, you know, it really helps just narrow down the field and see where you should be approaching things from.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. I mean, not only like when you have chemistry with a client and designer, sort of like that relationship, you know, it is really efficient. And I can imagine you'd have a savings in cost and time. And, you know, there would be a whole host of sort of reasons as to why you'd want to try and tee up every interaction that you have with a client like that. But as you mentioned, it's not always the case. So if you were to sort of try and replicate that, what would you love a client to come to you with? And you mentioned some sort of inspirational images and sort of even some examples of what they don't like. What kind of format do you like them to come with, like a Pinterest board, or sort of walk us through that?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends what people's comfort level is. So I don't want to recommend a certain platform if that's not what they already use, just because it's adding a layer that might not be helpful for them. But honestly, just the more information, the better. Like, I think a lot of people think they might be overwhelming you early on with a deluge of details, but you can't really have too many details, especially early on. So just putting thought into it. I mean, a lot of people come to me, they don't even tell me what the brand is in their initial email, right? And it's like that. I mean, so you've got a complete range of approaches. I get detailed 20-page PDFs, which is a project brief, which is excellent. And then I'll get, you know, what are your rates and what's your availability with no information about what the company is. It's like, I can afford to be selective. Like, I don't necessarily work with every single project that crosses my desk because it might not be a good fit. And you can kind of over the years learn to see those projects and know when you're not. And, you know, it's nothing personal. It's just like, you know, that there's a better person out there for them. And it's just really evident to you early on. So it's good to listen to those instincts and help people find the right person too. Like, it's not cutthroat competition, you know, like it can be a really mystifying thing, the creative arts, like when it comes to hiring somebody in that field. So I think just the more information that's out there and the more helpful you can be for people kind of stepping out on that path, the better off.
Yeah, that's cool. We often have a laugh here in the office. Like, we will get inbound leads, you know, people after some packaging, and we're like, yeah, sure, what are you after? I don't know. Well, what's your budget? I don't know. So, yeah. You know, do you have any examples of what you want? No, I don't know. And I always laugh and we have a joke around here because it's like you walk into a shoe shop. Hey, I'm after a shoe. Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Where are you going? I don't know. Well, what's the size of your foot? I don't know. Well, what's your budget? I don't know. Okay, well, I can't really help you until you have an idea of what it is that you're looking for here.
Yeah, yeah, and that next email is the one
yeah.
where you get your information from. Because if they go back and then they do the research and then they come yeah. back with all those answers,
yeah.
then you're golden, right? Like yeah. you never want to – that first email should be a fact-finding mission on both
Correct.
Sides.
Yeah, discovery.
So it's good. And then you see a lot of the client's intention when they come back and they've done that homework. And yeah. then they come and, you know, you're ready to go from there. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's totally the case. Like it yeah. can be challenging sometimes. Like, how did you expect this to go?
Yeah. And but, I guess,
you know,
yeah. Sorry.
Like a lot of people do expect that there's just a set rate for hiring a graphic designer.
Yeah.
It's maybe an hourly and you just go ahead with that rate. And that's just, unfortunately, not how it works. Like you're paying for experience, you're paying for a particular skill set. Like there's just this whole range of factors that go into any given agency or freelancer's quote, right? And so that's why I always tell people too, like you should be getting multiple quotes. Like don't just talk to one person because you want to weigh different things against each other. And they're going to be vastly different. Their approaches might be different, but a good freelancer or studio will be very forthcoming with all of that information. And if they're not, then that's not the right fit, right? So, yeah.
That's cool. No, thanks for all of that information. I guess the whole premise of this podcast is to pack heavy and have you know, the listener be able to pack heavy with the facts and the information that they need so that when they do approach a designer like yourself, they're coming armed with all of the knowledge and the information to try and make that transaction as smooth and as easy as possible. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be a designer. It could be with a broker or a distributor or somebody in marketing. And that's exactly why I'm sort of providing this podcast so that people can pack heavy on whatever part of the business that they're focusing on at the time. Now, I guess once you've sort of done the discovery piece and you know exactly what it is that the client's looking for and you've had the conversation around sort of what the vision is and sort of what the next steps look like for you and the relationship in that respect, do you actually undergo some sort of market research and sort of a competitor analysis and landscape of sort of what else is out there yourself, or is that something that you expect the client to do?
I don't personally I'm just like a one-man shop. So that's more of a studio approach where they'll have somebody on staff that will be doing that.
Okay.
And so for me, I also don't just do packaging. I don't just do branding. Like there's a lot of different projects I work on. So that's just not a specialty or specialized area that I've gone into. More of the, you know, the marketing stuff. Yeah, so typically clients will come to me and they've already done that. On a smaller scale too, like, it's amazing how much of that information you already have, even if you're not giving it credit, like just by shopping and knowing, for example, with the hot sauce, like I love hot sauce. So when Jordan came to me, it was easy to know what the competition was. It was already kind of baked in, especially locally for a local brand, because I shop at the local stores. These are products I already buy. So a lot of that is already there. But in terms of like presenting it to a client as a service that I charge for, that's just kind of part of my process, but it's not something that I really go into too in depth.
Right. So once
also like a lot, sorry, but a lot of the stuff I work on isn't local either. So that's when I'm really relying on their knowledge of their market. Like a longtime client is in France and, you know, I don't get to France very often. So, you know, I'm very much relying on their knowledge of their product and where it sits in the market.
Yeah. I also feel that Jordan was sort of right in your wheelhouse. And, you know, if you go back and you have a look at your portfolio of artwork, it fits really well within that sort of within exactly what you do. So I guess she was kind of lucky that she found you too.
Yeah. A big part of that too is finding the right person, because you will, when you start looking through people's work and portfolio, you'll gravitate towards certain things that you know are going to be a good fit. And, you know, sometimes it's nice to be asked to work outside of your comfort zone because you get some unexpected results and certain skills translate to any aesthetic. But I think one of the biggest things you can do if you are looking to hire a freelancer is just finding the right fit, you know, as much as possible, whatever that means for your particular project.
So when you're going through your design process, like where do you draw inspiration from? Like what do you look to? And sort of tell us a little bit about your creative process in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, everything's inspirational for me. Like, the interesting thing about design as a pursuit is like, you know, you can look out the window and be inspired by certain colors you see. And when you're walking down the street, like when you really start looking at it, everything is designed. Like we just live in such a hyper-designed world. Mm-hmm. So things that catch your eye, obviously, is on a daily basis, especially living in the city. Mm-hmm. My inspiration is actually the opposite. Like I will just go for a hike in the woods to just get away from everything. And that's when I really, you know, kind of have my best ideas. Mm. So just the balance, I guess, of not being, you know, too overwhelmed with every single thing bombarding you visually. But then in terms of things that inspire me directly, a lot of old vintage packaging, things that you'll see at flea markets and stuff, like around the 50s era. I've just always really loved that. Really simple printing, usually one or two colors. It's just kind of a timeless aesthetic back then, pre-digital. I think, you know, digital really shifted the design environment where it became way more accessible. But that's not always a good thing. Like there was a barrier to entry a generation, two generations ago, where you had to have a certain skill set in order to call yourself a graphic designer. And now you don't. You just need a computer and everyone's got one of those. So it's interesting. I think that's part of why I gravitate towards that era of design. There was just, it was more of a discipline back then.
I love, that's exactly the sort of the era that I love as well. Growing up, I used to collect Coke signs and Coke bottles. And actually my wife's dad, my father-in-law, he used to have this beautiful old workshop and he had, comic books and cigarette cartons and just the coolest stuff up on his walls. I think you've probably got a really good visual of exactly what it was. He was an upholsterer and he'd do like interiors of hot rods. And he had buddies that would do like all pinstriping by hand, just the coolest shit, like just immaculate work. And that's exactly the era that I love as well when it comes to design. And I think that's why I was drawn to your Instagram page as well.
Yeah. And then I also like the combination of like really detailed ornate work with gritty textural stuff. Yeah. It's just kind of a dichotomy that I like playing with.
Yeah.
Not every project calls for it, so it's kind of rare I get to bring both of those things together, but that's an aesthetic that I really enjoy.
Yeah, I saw that you'd done it like a potato stamp design. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that was funny. I did that when I was at CBC, and I remember posting it, and I was just cutting up potatoes at my desk, and nobody knew what I was doing until I posted it, and then they were like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
But that was super fun. It was definitely an experiment, but the textures that came out of that were great.
Yeah, back at home, I've got up on my wall like an old Mexican wrestling poster that was printed using like a print press and like the individual letters. And I was actually at a design conference. So back in 2003, I moved from my country town of Bendigo into Melbourne, and I was actually studying design for 12 months because I wanted to be a graphic designer as well. And I actually got into product design at university, but I deferred it and never went back. But for the 12-month course that I was doing design, I went to a design conference and got this poster, and there was like a limited run, and I proudly got it framed, and it's up on my wall, and I still love it now. But it's pieces like that. It actually reminded me of that potato stamp that you'd done, just because it was so unique.
Yeah, there's something about just even when you're like that poster you talk about, you end up with the indentations from the actual physical process of printing. And there's just something really that you can connect with when you have that.
Yeah. Actually, on Granville Island, I don't know the name of the business, but I think there's a guy with an old print press and he does business cards in sort of using that block method. Have you come across him at all?
No, I know there's a few of them. They're kind of the older. Yeah, yeah. That's cool. Though.
Yeah,
I mean, again, like the paper is really nice and thick. Like it's just a nice quality product.
Yeah. I was telling you before about back in 2010 to 2012, I was managing the Salt Spring Coffee on Main Street when it was there on Main and 27th. And one of our customers was a guy called Rob Dobie. Have you come across him before?
No.
So Rob, I think his background, he was a sign writer and he would do everything by hand, but he also does an incredible amount of illustration, murals, painting and mixed media. And he does pinstriping on hot rods as well. And he's an old hippie from way back. I think he's moved out to like Nova Scotia or something now, and he's got a farm and he's doing up hot rods and all that. But I'll have to send you his portfolio of artwork online as well. He actually did this really cool, I don't know if it was a mural or whether it was a painting, but he did like this Coca-Cola Santa drinking a Coke bottle. out drinking a bottle of Coke, which was awesome. And actually, what's the name of the Mexican restaurant on 4th in Kitts? It's like on the corner of 4th and Arbutus or one of those ones. It's like the logo is of like this Mexican woman. She's wearing like a sombrero. I'll also send you that, but he did that and he actually painted that onto their wall. It was really cool. But yeah, there's a lot of great designers out there that I draw a lot of inspiration from as well.
Yeah, especially those old methods that are starting to come back into fashion. Yeah, sign painting. I mean, you pay a premium for it, but you get what you pay for. Like when you get a vinyl sign, it's just in 3 years, it's going to be faded in the sun and peeling off your building. And it's going to look like garbage. And there's no, like, the rustic quality of a deteriorating vinyl sign is not attractive. Whereas, like, an enamel hand-painted metal, you know, that's just, it's going to end up in a museum at the end of its life. Like, it's just going to look better over time. So I think when people start to have that long view of like what's going to stand the test of time, it's, you really go back to that. But the problem is in the intervening years, like so many people lost that skill set that it's hard to actually find a sign painter now who's got the old methods.
Yeah. But, it's almost a trade. It's a trade that needs to be handed down.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some local people doing it, still doing shop windows and stuff.
Yeah. I hope it doesn't get lost. I just brought up my father-in-law. Like, he was an upholsterer for all of his years. Unfortunately, he's passed away now. So shout out to Al if he's listening. But he was doing everything by hand, and he learned in an era where, you know, it was all extremely manual. You know, he was like stretching the leather and like just the most intricate, most beautiful stuff. And he would get furniture from like yard sales and what are they called? Like auctions, and keep them up in the attic and just pull out a piece at a time. And he actually proudly said that there was not one piece of marketing material that he ever put out there. Like, his business was just all word of mouth, and he was never without business for all of these years. And, you know, raised the family on the income of that business as well, which was pretty incredible. But my brother-in-law, Lee, and I often say, like, imagine if he was around now producing that level of work and, you know, incredible detail, and he had Instagram and the ability to get his projects out there, it would have just been an incredible success, like to even greater levels, you know?
Yeah. It really depends. I mean, everyone's got their goals. Are sometimes just feeding your family, putting food on the table is all you need. Right? You don't need the fame and the fortune.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's a totally admirable pursuit.
Yeah. There's another project that I wanted to talk about with you that I did recognize, and that was Coffee Supreme, and they've been around for years. So tell us a little bit about the Coffee Supreme story.
Yeah, that was a really fun one. They just basically came to me and they were doing some limited edition diner mugs. So
yeah, I know the one.
I did two different mug. This was years ago, so like over 10 years ago. But two different mug designs. And then they released like an art print that went along with the mug.
Cool.
Just a fun project. They're a really cool company to work with.
Yeah. And like I said, they've got a cafe in Melbourne, and that's a really cool business story as well. Like, I've forgotten the owner's name, but he came out from New Zealand with a business, you know, model and idea in his suitcase and made it happen. And he was just one of those success stories. And I think they've got stores in quite a few other international locations as well. And I had no idea that you'd done that work. So it was really cool when I, you know, saw that. And also, 49th Parallel, I think, is a beautiful piece too.
Thanks. Yeah. That was a little bit of a packaging refresh I did with those guys. So
yeah.
And then their boxes as well. They did shipping boxes. So
yes. Yeah.
We did like an animal, West Coast animal inspired theme on those.
Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of Stumptown down in Portland and sort of
their
aesthetic that they have going on there too.
Yeah. I like Stumptown's approach to branding, because they don't really have a logo.
Yeah.
They just kind of change it up every single time. So it's always, I bring that up to clients as like the opposite of the Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
You know, your brand is etched in stone, never deviate from the path, whereas Stumptown, super successful business, just doesn't really even have one.
It's unique. Yeah.
They have great branding.
Multiple personas all wrapped up in one. Exactly. Yeah. There's St. Ali, which is a coffee roaster back in Melbourne, and they sort of have taken that approach as well. And they've sort of got some real sort of clean aesthetics, and I don't know how they sort of position that one, but they're definitely sort of targeting a certain audience with that one. And then they've sort of got multiple personas and personalities and pieces out there. And I don't know, it's such a cool approach that you don't see very frequently.
Yeah, it's nice when you can be playful with it, right? Because at the end of the day, the stakes are pretty low for a coffee company. So you just want to stand out and have fun with it, right? You know, depending on your approach. Some people just want to have a brand and never think about it again. They just use it employ it, and then that's good to go. And that's another great approach too. It really just depends what you want to do with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the fun projects are when you just kind of have a little more freedom to be playful.
Yeah. Are there any particular brands out there that you're like, damn, I wish I could have done that one, or you know, that you draw inspiration from, or that you're constantly going back to and going, geez, that's awesome?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm busy enough that like I don't have to kind of be staring at other projects yearningly. So yeah. I'm fortunate that way. But yeah, I mean, I'm always impressed by stuff. Like, yep. I don't think of it as competition. I think of it as just like inspiration. So yeah, there's yeah, just I think for me too, like things that are maybe outside of the approach I would take, I always really appreciate, because it's nice to see something approached from a completely different vantage point, and you just never would have thought of it that way. And if it doesn't make it right or wrong, it's just, it's cool to see that. Like when two people, you know, approach the same problem with completely different solutions, I find that really fascinating.
Now, being a small business owner as well, like you were just suggesting before, there are so many different pieces of the puzzle that you've got to sort of keep moving in, you know, as well as the design piece. What does your day-to-day look like, and sort of how do you manage all of those things? And are there any components of the business that you've outsourced?
Yeah, I mean, when I started, I was still doing web design, so I don't do that anymore. And so that involved working with friends who are, you know, more adept at Flash and certain coding skills. But I got away from that and focused more on the print side. So I don't outsource anything now. I prefer to keep it in-house. I can control my outcomes better. The only stress I ever really had in the business was around managing multiple deadlines with multiple people. So I can control a deadline. If I say I'm going to get it to you on Friday, I know that I can get it to you on Friday. Mm. But if I'm relying on somebody in the interim to get it to me on Thursday to get it to you on Friday, then that's where stress comes into it for me. So I just prefer to eliminate that from my day-to-day. It's so much nicer just to like rely on yourself. And then, you're not letting anybody down.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I agree. I guess, yeah, that time management piece and setting expectations early, it's important in whatever business you're operating. But when you've got multiple projects on the go and you're, you know, running solo, I can imagine that, you know, the stress that that would put you under at times.
I honestly, like I avoid stress at all costs. So it's very extremely rare. Like, it's, and again, it's just about managing expectations and then also knowing what you're capable of. Yeah, so, you know, sometimes you just have to say no to a project because you know that it's going to be too stressful, and it's not fair to your other clients that you've already agreed to these timelines for to take on too much work. So that's a big part of it, is just knowing when you cannot take on any extra work.
For sure. Going back to Sriracha Revolver, like how many hours would you have spent from start to finish on that project?
Yeah, it's not, I prefer to get away from the hourly mentality.
Okay.
So it's impossible to, you know, eliminate the hourly approach from a business completely.
Yeah.
But I approach it just as a project because I have my best thoughts in the shower, you know? Mm. So how do you bill for that? Like, I will be, like I say, I go for hikes, I go for bike rides, and I'm thinking like it's on the back burner and that's not, but those aren't billable hours, but I'm still working because I enjoy what I do. So we're thinking of it as an hourly too. Is like getting back to, not to say that I'm Picasso, but I always loved his anecdote, which is no doubt apocryphal at this point, but he was at a restaurant, somebody recognized him and said, oh, can you draw a picture for me? And so he scribbled something down and handed it to the person. They went to take it and he was still holding on to it. And he said, that'll be $500. And he said, what are you talking about? You just took 4 seconds. And he said, no, this took my entire lifetime. You know, obviously Picasso's a huge asshole, but that's an amazing story because it does ring true. You know, you spend your entire life building up these skills.
Yeah.
And then you're just going to like have an hourly rate that they're worth. That's just odd. Yeah. So I also enjoy the transparency of a project rate.
Yeah.
So when you have the quote up front, you know that this amount of work is going to be this price.
Yeah.
End of story. You know. Yeah. And if we go over, we can go over, and that's when an hourly might come into play or another quote. Yeah. But it's just a much nicer, tidier way to like think about it, and then you just kind of get away from that hourly paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like getting a Jordan signature. Could you imagine going up to Michael Jordan saying, hey, can you sign this basketball for me? And he goes, yeah, that'll be $5,500, please. And you're like, what do you mean? You just took 2 seconds to sign it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you build up the career that I had.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's funny, mate. let's just go back to an example of, I'm a small business owner and I've got an idea of, you know, the brand aesthetic and what it is exactly that I'm looking for. And I have put a bit of time together to get a bit of a Pinterest board together, creating some, you know, inspirational images and sort of the design aesthetic and the persona that I'm looking to achieve. And I contact you and you and I have our first discovery meeting and we've got an idea of exactly what it is that I'm looking for. What else can I come to you with to sort of help promote a really smooth transaction with you and give you all of the tools that you need for a successful sort of design outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really depends. Like every project is just so different. But like if you take packaging as an example,
yep.
You know, there's a lot of practical elements at play. So things like the UPC code, yep. the nutritional information, making sure that your package is bilingual and that you've done that translation, like, or, you know, at least have opened the door to that or considered it. So there's just a lot of practical elements that come into play that's good to, you know, have wrapped your head around. I also appreciate when people have given some thought to their budget. You know, I've gone very far down a discovery path with people and then, you know, it comes time to put the proposal together and they're like, oh, like my budget was $50. And it's like, you know, early when I asked, what's your budget? You should have just told me you don't have
one. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that doesn't necessarily exclude you from the process either. Like depending on whether or not it's you know, a not-for-profit or what your circumstances are, like the money landscape can adapt. It's not like no money or very little budget excludes you completely, but it's good to be upfront about that so that we don't go too far before, especially if it's a commercial project that you're expecting to make money off and you don't have any money to invest upfront. So
there's
a lot of pieces to the puzzle, but like I say, no project's the same, no two projects. So just the more thought you've given to something, it's really evident early on, and that's that's the most helpful.
Yeah, coming prepared. I understand. It is really hard. Like there is no one shoe that fits everybody, but at the same time, you know, everybody has an expectation of what it is that they're looking to, you know, garner from a design process like that. And, you know, Clay from Eggbeater and also the guys from Little Fox said exactly the same thing. You know, every single transaction is different. So I can imagine over the years you would have had a ton. Have there been any, you know, and we don't have to name names or anything like that, but have there been any experiences that you've had where you're like, damn, that went sideways? And what could have you have done in hindsight to have sort of changed it so that it was an easier transaction?
Yeah, I mean, the projects that end up going sideways, it's very rare, luckily. You get better over the years at kind of determining potential problem clients or at least the traits that they might have early on in the process.
Yes.
It usually revolves around demand of your time. So if somebody is calling you late at night, first thing in the morning, not respecting the time difference and waking you up at 5 a.m, you know, there's just a certain level of expectation that like, I have other work I'm doing and like, I'm not your own, you're not my only client.
You're not exclusive. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people are just kind of me monsters essentially. And so you, like I said, you usually can figure that out really early, and the vast majority of people are wonderful to work with. I've been really fortunate, but yeah, every once in a while it does happen. Usually you just give them their money back and go away, and that's always a luxury that you have working for yourself, which is always in your back pocket, and it's a huge amount of freedom knowing that you could just give them their deposit back and say, I'm sorry it didn't work out, leave on good terms, but you know, best of luck finding another person. I've done that once in like years and years and years. So this is an exceptionally rare scenario. I don't want to make it sound like I'm firing people left and right, but that is your luxury, is work for yourself, right? Like you're your own boss. And so as much as you respect the client, and you know, they're the one feeding you, you know, you can afford to be selective.
Yeah. Mate, you've been doing this for 15 years now, and I'm just interested to know what's on the horizon for you at Little Ugly. Like, are you going to still keep moving in the same direction, or are you looking to grow the business or just keep it as status quo and just keep moving confidently in what you're comfortable doing?
Yeah, I mean, work's not everything for me. So I guess if I was focused on just like being the biggest, most successful designer, then yeah, I would definitely say growth. But just I'm always just feeling fortunate that I have enough work to work for myself. So
yes.
That's just such a luxury, especially in the last year, you know, with the amount of precarious employment out there. It's just been an absolute blessing to be able to work from home and have steady employment. So I don't take that for granted at all. And any excess time I have, I think just doing things that aren't work related but are still creative, is it just kind of recharges your batteries. So whether that's printmaking or just doing a design project or an illustration solely for yourself that you don't even post to Instagram, because it's just outside of that work paradigm, it's that's really valuable to me. And just having more free time too, like is huge, because I spent so long just burning the candle at both ends, working two jobs. And I kind of just made that conscious choice at a certain point that like I would rather go for hikes in the mountains on a day off than take on extra work. So, and I think my projects benefit from that because I don't get burnt out as a result. So yeah, I don't think any sort of exponential growth is in the cards for me, that's for sure.
Yeah. You're obviously somebody that, you know, likes to work with their hands, and you're extremely artistically inclined and sort of always using that side of your brain. What other sort of activities do you sort of embark on to sort of create that balance in your life? You're like, you just mentioned hiking and so on, but, you know, do you read, like, do you listen to music? Like, what other sort of activities do you undertake?
Yeah, lots of music, lots of films. I'm big into gardening. I've gotten more into gardening over COVID.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's been a lot really of my common. Time. So yeah,
that's huge. Started more of a veggie garden last year. And just building stuff too. I just love building stuff, just collecting tools and things around the house, and just like, yeah, putting things together. It's just,
do you have a workshop at home, or do you work out of a community?
Not even remotely workshop worthy. Yeah. It's just a collection of tools in the garage, but it gets the job done when I need to.
What projects have you got going on at the moment?
Well, I just did some tiling stuff. I put a bathroom in the garage.
All right.
So that it could potentially be a studio. So
yeah,
just tiling that and putting in a shower and a toilet and stuff. So that was obviously a lot more than I bargained for initially. Yeah. It was a good albatross of a project over COVID.
That's awesome.
But, now that it's done, it's amazing to have.
Awesome, mate. Well, look, I've learned a ton from you. And like I said early on in the podcast, the whole premise of, you know, what I'm trying to do here with the podcast is to arm all of the listeners with as much information that they can sort of get to make, you know, whatever they're undertaking in their business smooth. And you know, like I say, I like to call that packing heavy. So I think you've really given us so much information so that people can pack heavy on the design process and, you know, embark on a journey with a designer to make it a really smooth and easy program. So mate, thank you very much. If, like I mentioned before, there are so many different ways that people could get in touch, but what's the primary way that you like people to reach out and get in contact with you?
I guess I'm old fashioned because email is the way to go. Whenever people send me direct messages and stuff, I usually don't even see them because I keep most social media at a very healthy arm's distance. So email's definitely the way to go.
Awesome. Well, look, mate, I will make sure that when the episode goes live, I include your website and your Instagram links and all of that kind of stuff in the podcast notes so that people can have a look at your work and reach out if they feel so inclined.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Take care, mate. Bye.
Yeah, cheers.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.